daddy@qr.com.
Good morning. We have three people with us today. Nitara Frost on the line with us from Minnesota, right?
Yes, from Minnesota.
And you are the parent support specialist for LGBTQ parents at the North American Council on Adoptive Children.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
I just want to credit my husband for getting through that entire thing. It was very good.
Very long. I know. Good.
You're also an adoptive mom of five.
Yes. My wife and I adopted five children from foster care. We were foster parents first, and then now we are adoptive parents to five children.
Wow.
How old are they?
Our oldest is 14 and our youngest just turned 9.
It's not even that much of a spread.
We were a 5 under 5 family for a while. That was a lot.
You're so brave.
Yeah, really. A round of applause.
Thank you.
We also have Ufe De La Torre. Yeah?
Correct, yeah.
He's a former social worker in the child welfare and currently a therapist.
That's right.
You also adopted.
Yes, my husband and I adopted 2 children at birth. We went the private adoption route because our oldest is now 18 in his first year of college and our second is in high school. So when we started the process, even though I was in child welfare at that time, the Department of Children and Family Services was starting to get the ball rolling on understanding gay families. And so we were at the very front end of it, and we waited like for a year to be matched. So then we went to a private adoption route, and it happened really quickly.
Great. And we have also Ethan with us. Alex and I are less experienced in the whole adoption parenting side of it. So we brought somebody to tell his story and be on the parent side with us. Ethan Cohen is an adoptive father of 2 and a partner at the Century City Entertainment law firm, Del, Shaw, and Moonves.
That's correct.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How old are your kids?
Our oldest is 6. He just turned 6. And our youngest is going to be 3 months in about 2 weeks. So he's 10 weeks on Monday.
And you're here and you look well-pressed and awake. And
I didn't sleep a lot, but I am here.
Wonderful.
Did you have them the same way, like private adoption?
Different. Our oldest we did through foster adoption. And our youngest, we did through private adoption. So
okay.
We've experienced both routes.
Is this time for us to start out just by defining those two
things?
Yes,
let's just define the ways of adoption that we have. So, Nitara, why don't you explain to us what kind of adoptions gay parents can go through?
So one of the typical ways that you end up seeing on movies and things is the private adoption route, where you go through an agency, they work with you and get a home study. And then they have things like lookbooks where a birth parent is actually picking out a family that they're interested in. And sometimes that the birth families don't necessarily pick it out, depending on the different agencies. The other routes are adoption from foster care. That's when the parents go and do some training through the state and become foster parents. And sometimes you end up fostering the kids and the kids go back to the biological parents or go to an adoptive home or go to relatives. And sometimes then it ends up being an adoption from the foster parents actually adopt. Some states have what's called foster to adopt or concurrent planning foster homes. And those homes are homes that are not strictly foster homes. So they would like to adopt if the children become available to adopt. So that's kind of the foster care side of it. Then there's also adoption from the state, where kids are actually in foster homes waiting to be adopted. They are a ward of the state. The birth parents no longer have rights. So you can adopt from the state, but without technically doing foster care. I mean, I guess there's always that 3-month time that you have to. There's a 90-day period typically in most states where the children are with you and technically it's foster care. However, at that time, they're kind of getting the ball rolling on the adoption and getting that process going. And that's with older kids typically, but it can also be with some younger or sibling groups. And then there is international adoption. Obviously, adoption from overseas and internationally, which has changed a lot in the past few years. Actually, in like the past 10 years, it's changed a lot. Yeah, so those are the
What's the difference between adoption with a private attorney and an agency?
A private attorney, when, if you're specifying when potentially families, this actually happens, maybe like a teen mom, an example would be like a teen mom in a family is looking to find a family themselves for the baby potentially, and they know the family or there's potentially a relative, and then they sometimes hire a private attorney to go ahead and do the adoption process and fill out and do the home study and everything instead of going through an actual agency that the birth parent has gone to help find a family.
Yeah, you know, I was actually wondering, I'm sure that the numbers are very small on this, but there must be adoptions that go on even within extended families or between close friends. That does happen.
Are, especially with the days of right now and social media and Facebook and all of that. A lot of people are putting, I get some that pop up randomly sometimes on my feed that, you know, looking for a family, hoping to adopt, things like that. And there are some times where people will reach out and that becomes a connection and then they go that private attorney route. I do not know, I have not had any of my families that I work with do that as of yet. So I don't know the complete logistics on all of that, but I know that instead of going through an agency, everything is done through the attorneys.
Okay, so Ethan, you had like two ways of adoption out of what she mentioned. So can you tell us a little bit about your story? There's also like a fraudulent adoption in between. So please tell us the whole thing.
Yeah, I'll try to give you somewhat of the shorter version because it can be a long story. But so with our first son, you know, when I first decided I wanted, well, I always knew I wanted to have kids. As I was getting older, I was single, and I wanted to move forward. I didn't want to wait. And foster adoption was really the most welcoming to anybody. They were very open and clear that it didn't matter whether you were single or married, gay or straight, black, brown, white, thin or fat. If you could provide for a great family, then they were open to you, you know, coming in, taking the classes, and if you could be certified, then you were eligible to either be a foster parent or do exactly what Natara said, be a foster adoptive parent, which is essentially concurrent planning. So I did that, and I was relatively clear that I wanted the lowest risk possible, which, as Ufe knows, is kind of a misnomer because there is never a low risk, because in California, at least, the goal is always to reunify. And in the training, you know, when you first hear that, it's very contrary to what you want. You're there to adopt. They are bringing you in this concurrent planning to adopt, but they tell you you have to be open to the child going back to the parent. So it's a very difficult situation to be in, and you tell yourself, okay, I'm open to that. But we, you know, after I did the training, literally, they said, when are you open to a child? And I came up with a date based on kind of work and whatnot, and that was irrelevant. They called me the next day and said, hey, we have, you know, this child. And they started running down the scenarios. And the first group of them I had said no to because it just seemed like the child was going to reunify quickly, despite them saying that he or she wouldn't. It just didn't seem like a huge issue. With the son who we have, they said, here's the situation. We don't see him being reunified. He has five other siblings that we're trying to adopt. We're going to do it as a quote unquote fast track. There's going to be no reunification services. And are you interested? I said, yes. And they said, okay, we'll see you in 4 hours. So I literally left work with a list that a friend of mine who has two kids made for me, went straight to Babies R Us, like on an episode of Supermarket Sweep, never looked up, just putting everything in the cart, because you don't know whether you're getting a boy or a girl, you know, as you go through the process, what the age will be, so you can't really prepare for the exact needs. Right. So you're not gonna pre-buy clothes in every single size and all that. So literally I'm running through the store, get everything, get home, and Ufe was the matcher at the time, so he showed up before the social worker.
What do you mean by the matcher? Can you just explain that to us?
I carry a wand and I match people. It's
very magical. We all carry a wand.
A matcher is basically what Ethan described is once the family gets certified, the matcher meets with the family. We review all their needs, all the, you know, what they're open to, the risk levels. And then we wait for those phone calls that come in. And then we look at our families that we have available and we make the call.
So that means you were the one who called him.
I did.
To say we'll be over in 4 hours. Oh,
yes,
okay. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So please continue.
Yeah. And so, you know, our son came home and basically at the first court date, everything changed. And they said, oh, we actually are going to do reunification, but we think the judge is going to do it because she really wants to dot her I's and cross her T's and make sure that the grounds for appeal are minimized. And so she doesn't want to offer nothing and then, you know, have room for appeal. So it was frustrating, but understandable. That judge was then left that courtroom. A new judge came in. The new judge made it very clear. I'm very pro-parent. I don't think children should go to adoptive homes or foster homes. I think we should do whatever we can to return them to the biological parent. End of story. The social worker from the county said, this is going to be a rough ride, and it's going to be a lot different than what we said. And she definitely wants to return him to the birth parent. And she's also trying to return the other four kids where services had already been terminated to the birth parent. She was trying to reverse everything that the other judge had done. So as we continued to go through court, she then gave visitation rights. And then she then started to give overnight visitation rights. And so the social worker said, this is, you know, probably he's probably going to wind up being reunified. But really, and it's hard to describe, the minute he comes or she comes into your home, it's your child. And if you want to adopt, the bond is instantaneous. And so the thought of reunification is beyond comprehension. And so I worked with the agency that, you know, I did it through a private agency or a public agency, not directly through the county, and to try to say, what can we do to avoid this? And their position was, nothing, you should stay out of the process. You just have to let the process go, you know, as it's supposed to. And that was not something that I could really accept. And so I spoke to the child gets appointed an attorney, which is called Minors Counsel. The county also has an attorney who represents them. And then you have the county social worker in addition to the social worker from the agency.
Who's representing the birth mother at that point?
She actually, in this case, had her own private attorney.
So
otherwise,
yet another
party. They can have somebody appointed. She had a private attorney.
Wow.
The county social worker was very, very, was a great ally. And I think the biggest advice I have is that is a person who really can determine your fate. And she and I got along very well. She really did not want any of the kids going back. She had been working on the case since the first of the other four children, and thought that for a multitude of reasons, the conditions did not warrant reunification. So she supported me being active in the process to help him be adopted, and which was great. And so what happened was what seemed like a terrible thing, the visits where he could go with the birth mother, he didn't want to go, even at a few months old. He would scream, he would hold onto my shirt to the point that literally ripped the buttons off. She could not get him. She couldn't even hold him. He would never stop crying. He would come back and he was sick. He would throw up. And it was very evident that there was a problem. And it was more than just me wanting him to stay with me. And so as I said that to the social worker, she started to come and watch that. And she saw it and said, I've rarely seen anything like this. She then did interviews and the birth mother said, I didn't want him. But I'm not willing to not fight under principle, but I didn't want him. And so she continued to document that to the court. The court continued on its path, completely disregarding what was going on, but it got so bad. And then there was doctors that got involved, and there was a child psychologist that got involved, and the Department of Mental Health for the county got involved. And they went and they did a visit when he was with the birth mother. And then they did a visit unannounced when he was with us. And they said, if I didn't know, I wouldn't think it was the same child. When he was at the birth mother's house, he was just sitting in the corner crying. And when he's here, he's happy and there's a personality and there's a little child. And so they then supported not having the unmonitored visits. And then it actually, the judge scaled it back again to monitored, which was the beginning of everything shifting in our favor. And then, you know, fast forward, you have everything works in 6 month chunks. And so, you know, they give, you know, reunification services for 6 months at a time. And it's kind of like, and I said it's analogous to somebody who's terminally ill, because you're living your life in these 6 month chunks.
Right.
And you literally don't know at the next court date, will our son go back to the mom? Or will we be allowed, you know, to adopt him and move forward with that path? But at each 6 months, they kept giving her another chance. But she never improved. He never created any bond whatsoever for her. The psychologist said there literally is no bond whatsoever. And they still tried to see if they could fix it, because it's what the state requires. And never was there any connection. And eventually, the judge, based on all of the documentation of the psychologists and the social workers and the doctors, saying there is nothing to support that this child should be anywhere other than with us, she agreed to terminate reunification services. And then eventually terminate parental rights. And then eventually we could adopt. But the birth mother appealed every single step of the way. Mm-hmm. And so it took 4 years to finalize the adoption.
Wow.
And we were told at the beginning, it should be done in 6 months.
Yeah. Well, surprise, huh?
And then you had the fraudulent one. So I can't believe that after that you went for another one.
So then we always wanted to have two kids. We wanted our son to be a part of the process. And he really wanted another brother or sister. But we were, and in talking to Ufe as well about another, we were reluctant to do foster adoption, although we really believe in it. Because we think it's an amazing way to help a child have a life that they otherwise couldn't have. But the risk, I always say that the experience we had was the worst experience of our life with the greatest result. And to go through that again, if it's just us, as bad as it is, we're two adults and we can deal with it. But there was no way our son was ever going to understand if his brother or sister reunified. So we decided to go down the route of private adoption. And we thought, oh, this will be super easy. Well, it isn't super easy. After about 8 months of, you know, our profile was out there. We were doing it through an attorney, not an agency. We actually got a call from the company that did our home study and said, hey, there's another attorney that called us with a situation. That's what they call it. And we think it would be great for you. Do you want to talk to him? And we did not know this attorney. And we went in and he said, hey, I have this birth mother and we want to match you guys via video, which is different than what we had been doing. Normally we have a profile, our attorney would send it to prospective birth mothers and they would make a decision. So we did a video chat with this woman and right on the spot, this attorney said, okay, you have to make a decision. And we were kind of thrown off and it felt a little bit pressured, but we had been waiting for eight plus months. And so we said, okay, let's do it. Long story short, she didn't even have, she wasn't even pregnant. At some point, she was pregnant because there was medical records, except they stopped at a certain point. And we kept saying to the attorney, where's the rest of the records? What's going on? And she kept asking us for more money, for more problems, for more things. And you're so emotionally invested that you're going to Western Union and you're wiring $1,000, $1,500. And the attorney, it turns out, really had never vetted her. And I won't say who he is, but anybody's welcome to ask me privately. He never really vetted her. And had he vetted her, he would have known that there's an issue when you don't have medical records after a certain date. And basically, she kept trying to string us along. The birth date came, no baby. She then came up with another story. Then she called to say she was arrested and going to jail. And we had to quickly get her money so she didn't have the baby in jail. And that just went on and on. And then we said, we don't believe anything you're saying. Give us proof of the pregnancy. And then she went silent. And there was never any baby born. And probably what happened is she either switched doctors and was doing this maybe with another family, maybe kept the baby. Maybe she had a late-term miscarriage or something and saw this as a way to get money. But whatever it was, there was no baby for us to adopt, and we had, you know, paid a lot of money, that we never got back. And the attorney said, I'm not giving you any of the money back. Wow. And so it was a terrible situation. But then we went back to our phenomenal other attorney, and eventually we matched in an kind of amazing story. He called us on a Monday morning, and he said, "Check, please call me at the office ASAP. I have a situation, but it's very timely."
Situations.
Yeah. And yeah. we had probably submitted to about a dozen, and we had probably said no to about another dozen for various reasons. He said, "A woman just called me, and she is in labor. She has had no prenatal care. She doesn't know if it's a boy or a girl. She lives in Las Vegas. I did the adoption for a friend of hers. There are some other issues, you know, health issues, potential health issues and things like that, potential drug use, things you should know about. Are you, and the mom is half Hawaiian and half white, and the dad is half black and half Hispanic. However, she only wants a single or a same-sex couple. Are you interested?" Yes. We had done a lot of research. We kind of know what health things are better or worse between smoking and drinking and cocaine and methamphetamines, because it's surprising some things aren't as bad as you would think. So we said yes. We got on the phone with her 10 minutes later. She was having contractions on the phone. Oh, we had a great conversation.
There's your evidence that she was pregnant. Yeah, right.
And we had a great conversation. We sent her our profile. 25 minutes later, our attorney texted us and said, "Congratulations, she selected you.
Wow.
Call her." We called her. We got her voicemail. And,
not surprisingly.
And he said, "Well, she's probably on her way to the hospital." Literally 2 hours later, so about 2 hours and 25 minutes after we first spoke to her, we got a text, "Congratulations, you have a son." Mm-hmm. And she was in Las Vegas. We literally both left work. We got in the car. We drove to Las Vegas, and we were at the hospital at 7 in the morning. And we met her, and we met our son, and he's healthy, and she couldn't have been any nicer, and she's terrific. And so that's how that one came to be, but it was a long road.
I think you deserved the second experience after the middle experience.
This is like three different stories of two adoptions. Nitara, what do you think about this?
It's common. A lot of, especially the story from the foster care, is very common. That takes a long time. Typically, reunifying with biological parents is every judge's main goal, and it, as it should be, if it's possible. When a new judge comes in, you know, not knowing what another judge has done or just not looking at it, that sometimes gets a little dicey in there. But usually that is the best option, because all adoptions have trauma with them. Any bond that's broken between a biological parent and the child is going to create some kind of trauma, whether it's known or unknown. Typically teens and older kids, you're going to see more of that. But as babies grow older, you're going to see some things come out too when they get older. But it's with foster care, they try to reunify first, especially because if they don't try enough and a birth parent can say, "They didn't give me a chance and now I'm clean," you know, that can come back later on when you're almost done with finalizing to start everything over again.
Right.
But a lot of our parents that, you know, that we're going through things with, it takes a long time. We have also had, and a lot of the families I work with, they'll be like, "This one's a no-brainer." Like, that's what they say. They'll say, "This one's a guarantee," and you just can't even listen to it. Like, you have to just make them sound like the Charlie Brown teacher and just, you know, hope that you don't hear all that and take it all in. But then you can't help doing that, because, like Ethan said, like, you just are so excited about being a parent and you're holding a child.
Yeah.
With, like, you just fall in love immediately, and that's all you hear. Even though you've done the training, you know that this is not your child yet. You can't help it.
How much do we know about the reasons that women give their children up for adoption?
I can tell you from my experience, because, you know, with our birth mother, this was her 10th child with the private adoption.
Uh-huh.
And she had some substance abuse problems, and she knew that she was not going to test clean, and the baby was going to be placed on a state hold, and so would probably go straight to foster care and potentially be a foster adoption. And so she chose to speak to an attorney and put him up for private adoption to avoid that whole process and to have a connection to the parents. And also because what she told us is she was not in a place where she could care for a 10th child. And so it was a conscious decision that A, she didn't want him to go into the foster care system, or her, she didn't know. And yeah. she really knew that it might, her life couldn't sustain it.
Got it.
Yeah, I think the dividing line is if you're looking at a child through the welfare system, it's because the parents have found themselves in a situation where they have lost custody mm-hmm. of the children or the child to be born because of drug use or...
Right, rather than having given the child
rather up. Than a teenager saying, I'm not ready, somebody who's had 10 children and said, I can't do this anymore, or because the life that they are leading at that time doesn't accommodate having another child. So it's choice versus...
Interesting. Oh, very interesting.
Versus no choice of...
So generally, if it's their choice, then they're going to do the more ordered process of trying to do a private
correct.
Adoption.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, sometimes the divide on that is cultural and poverty as mm-hmm. well. I think with foster and adopt, what we see a lot is mental health, poverty, drugs, addiction, abuse, death actually lines up in that because sometimes there are no other family members.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a lot of things. It's not always, people always assume that drugs are involved. They right. are not always involved. However, drugs and alcohol and addiction, that's a big part of it. But that's also a big part in the private sector as well. It's just a lot of private sector adoptions, the babies are not necessarily tested for that.
Right.
Don't know.
Is there any homophobia in the whole system from your experience?
Yeah, I definitely think that there is and has been. And I've worked with couples who have had, my wife and I have had encountered it. And I know many other couples that we've talked to have encountered it as well. It's kind of all over, you know.
How about in the actual formalized sense in the United States? We won't talk about adoption in Iran because I'm going to assume that that's a different stat. Are there states, and forgive my ignorance here, I should know this, are there states in the union where there are actual laws or policies against adoption for LGBT parents?
All right. So a few years ago, I worked with all states. And so I knew a little bit more exactly about the very current and up to date on that. I still know Florida, Texas can be harder with everything that just recently went. I don't know where things are going now, but with what's happening currently.
Nor do we all.
Yeah, none of us do, right? But there were states that were like flat out denying it. You had to either be a single parent adopting alone, which means even though we had just had the right to get married, you couldn't get married if you wanted to adopt kids.
Wow.
So that you could do a single parent adoption because you can't do a single parent adoption as a married couple.
Oh, that's very interesting. Right.
So that was something that some families would do to get around that is just not get married then. But then that's a whole nother, you know, it's a whole nother issue, obviously. Right. I don't currently know.
So the homophobia comes from the state, not from the parents.
I think workers, you know, people, I think you get separate workers. I think you get judges that are homophobic. I think you get workers. I think it just kind of depends. There are agencies that are outright do not believe that or have a policy against adapting to LGBT families.
Well, there are religious agencies, aren't there?
Yeah, there's some states that part of their recent changes is that they do allow agencies to discriminate. In other words, that they can make a choice as an agency whether they will work with gay couples.
So, and what, I would say as a parent or prospective parent, whether it's foster adoption or private, you get a sense pretty quickly. In mm-hmm. LA County, they're incredibly open and they make it very clear. And we never encountered any homophobia whatsoever from the social workers, from the courts or anybody at all. I'm sure some of it exists, but we never saw it. And that was important. And the agency, you know, that we worked with, Children's Bureau, was incredibly welcoming as well. And it was just an unbelievable array of different kinds of people in the training. Again, married, single, gay, straight, you know, old, young, some people that didn't speak English well, you know, different varying educations, different economic levels. So that was incredibly welcoming. And what I'd say if you're doing private adoption, work with an agency or an attorney who focuses on, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual matches. Because our attorney, who was terrific, really that was one of his focuses. So he's only really matching us with birth mothers or birth parents who are open to that. Because otherwise, you're just going down this road and you're never going to match.
Right.
Yeah.
There are couples out there that wait years and then turn to organizations like one I worked for in the past. But there are organizations that help people find agencies that are LGBT friendly. Adopt US Kids know some of that information. Raise a Child has that information. And the Human Rights Campaign actually does training with agencies, and you can look on their website and find that information state by state as well.
Oh, that's great.
So you're saying that basically if we encounter homophobia during the process, just to reach out to those organizations?
Correct.
Yeah, to find, or prior to, well, actually, I think you do it, you reach out to those organizations to look for the agencies in your area that are LGBT friendly. I mean, I know that in California, it is very open. However, I worked with families out there that did encounter homophobia and said, where should I go? Because this place, they will not call us back. And it was more often with gay men. It was, and it was single gay men. And, you know, it's just, it's something that is a problem. And I believe that it's the separate people, right? You have a whole organization that does a training and they're great and this organization is good, but you've got one person who maybe, you know, has a different idea, and so they do things differently themselves.
Well, so I think the other issue here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that unlike the question of baking a cake for a gay wedding or whether or not you will serve me coffee at your in your coffee shop, when it comes to adoption, there's an incredibly kind of fuzzy set of considerations that go into whether or not this child should be given to this parent or that parent. And considerations that would never be even constitutional are actually allowed to be taken into account. So I think this is true. Considerations of race are actually allowed in the adoption process, right? So I think what ends up happening is, you're right, you want to start out with somebody who you, an organization that you know is not homophobic, because if they are homophobic, they can hide that information easily in their selection process, and there would be no way of you knowing whether you weren't selected because you're gay or you weren't selected because of a million other considerations that they can say that it's about.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And you can see it through different things, and there's different ways to take care of it. But again, it's hard, especially in the foster adopt world, it's hard to kind of speak up about it because you are pretty much constantly in the state of, I'm just, you know, you're trying to take care of the kids, and then you don't want them to be removed from you. So you don't want to kind of shake the boat with
right.
that. Mm-hmm. But people can go to supervisors. Every social worker has a supervisor. So that's one way to go, especially if you know the agency is LGBT friendly, and just say that's kind of the idea that you're getting. And they're not going to probably come right out and say that they don't want them to be with you because of that, but they might, who knows.
Right.
A lot of other ways that we've heard it coming out is not being, going through the whole matching process with a three-year-old boy, a six-year-old girl, but then the worker said, well, you're probably not the right fit to men because who's going to teach her about her period? And things like that. And it's like, well, you know, that's not, first of all, anyone can do that. And then
you can Google it, can't
not,
you?
Right.
Or listening to our podcast.
Right, or listen to the previous
on raising
episode.
Girls.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways. And, you know, just that it was kind of that was the first kind of indicator for this family that, like, wait a minute, something's going on. And then they started noticing little things and realizing this worker was trying really hard not to place with them.
Right.
So.
We had seven social workers on our first son, you know, because they just keep changing and getting. Right. And I can just tell you, and I'm not, you know, disagreeing that there isn't, that there's homophobia in some places, but not one of the seven had any issue with it. And I think in Los Angeles, and Uwe can attest this, they are so busy. And there's, I think, 37,000 kids in foster care in LA County.
Wow.
They want to put them in the best family. And I have to say, you know, we had some phenomenal ones. We had some terrible ones, not because they were homophobic, because they just just didn't seem to care.
Right.
But most of them were phenomenal, and they really were looking for the best family.
Look, right. I think one of the problems with where we do this podcast from is
a bit of a bubble.
We're going to have to look. We're going to start doing this podcast from Tennessee, starting never.
Do you think that people can reach out to social workers in other states? Is that even possible?
No, you have to do. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in, but you have to work within the state that you that you're living in. You can't do false adopt across.
But you could do private adoption.
You could do private adoption, yeah. But in terms of the if you're looking at false adopt, it has to be within usually the county and the state that you're living in.
Yeah, you can't go to, like, unless you're doing a private adoption, people can't just go out to LA and jump in over there. You know, it's a totally separate thing. That the only time when they do something like that is when kinship is involved, and they're looking people who are relatives. So,
Okay, I wanted to go over some of the myths that I got from gay dads that I collected throughout the couple latest months. We actually went through all of them. We talked about all of them, but there's only one that we haven't touched, which is single gay men, especially single gay men, are being pushed down the list of adoption and wait more time to be matched. What do you guys think about it?
What I've seen is that all single adoptions typically get pushed down the list because with a lot of adoptions, they want one of the parents to be home while the other one is working. And with a single family, you have to work. And I think that's kind of a big thing. I don't know if that's separated out to single men or not, but I know that with a lot of the single parents in general that I work with, that can be a big thing. Unless they have a family member that lives with them that is helping do the child care and things like that. And that's for all ages too, because a lot of times when you're looking to adopt older kids, we talked a lot about younger today, but like with the teens and the elementary school kids, they need, those are kids that need someone there at home with them. They can't just be hanging out and by themselves a lot. So yeah, I think that's across the board a single thing. I don't know if it's a single gay man thing. I don't think that that's
I agree with you on that, that it is across the board. And a lot of it is the logistics of it, right? That that they're, especially with the older kids, you do need, as Antara says, you do need somebody at home that can, especially in the early stages when they're having trouble in school and talking to the teachers and taking time from your schedule. So yeah, I think it's just more of a single.
One myth that, or one perceived myth that's actually, it's not on your list, but it's not there, that we encountered, is that a lot of birth mothers prefer single or married gay men because there's never going to be a replacement for the mother.
Oh.
And there's something in them, and we spoke to our attorney about this a lot, and it's much less threatening to them because no one's ever going to call the child mom.
Right.
Right. And so whether it's one dad or two dads, they actually like that, and that's why, surprisingly, we saw a lot of birth mothers that said, we only want a same-sex male family.
Yeah. How interesting.
Interesting.
So that actually helps.
Let's talk a little bit about preparations. So what research? I mean, Ethan, you kind of touched on the fact that you guys did some drug research.
Well,
but what kind of research do you have to do before deciding?
Well, I think the biggest thing for us in the beginning is cost and time, because foster adoption doesn't cost anything, and actually the state pays you a stipend, you know, if you finalize the adoption. And so if cost is a factor, you know, foster adoption is a preferred route. Timing wise, as I said in the beginning, we were getting calls within an hour basically of finalizing the training. Mm-hmm. So if you're in some place like Los Angeles, it's much quicker foster adoption. In terms of research on the private adoption, one of the things we looked at, because a lot of the birth parents have a lot of different drug issues, is what are the different, how significant are the problems? And, you know, I'm not a doctor, so I won't give the advice, but, you know, one of the things we found out is that smoking is worse than methamphetamines, for example.
In terms of transferring problems to the fetus.
Yeah, and so I would encourage anybody to do independent research, speak to their pediatrician, and see what they think, because it was very different than what we just thought before we did the research. And there was things that we were open to that we may not have been, and things that we really said no to, like smoking. People, and a lot of them smoke. And our pediatrician said, you know, two packs a day, you know, the fetus is being deprived of oxygen, and there's lots of other problems. So I think the medical research is important.
And then also I think doing the legwork of identifying, whether it's through the HRC or through referrals through friends that have been through the process, is identifying two or three agencies and actually take the time to go on their websites and make a phone call and see what that how they relate to you on the phone, and go to their training and get a sense of who's there to see what culture they have at the agency.
Right.
So, don't be afraid to do the legwork. Don't be afraid to interview, to really put yourself
And if you're doing private, you know, your attorney or agency should tell you this, but definitely know or research how the states, different states that you may, you know, find a birth mother in, treat the adoption, and whether you're going to finalize it in your home state or that state. Mm-hmm. So ours was Las Vegas, which was relatively easy, but we were still in Las Vegas for a week after he was born before we could leave and the interstate mm-hmm. adoption paperwork finalized. But there's some states where you have to go before a judge.
Right.
And the process is much worse. And so that's an important factor that a good attorney or agency will tell you about.
What kind of things the social service look at when they come to
To certify you?
Yeah.
There's sort of the preliminary things that might rule you out is whether you have a record, because you get fingerprinted. You make sure that you have a clean record, that you're in good health, that your living situation is stable, that you have enough of an income to take care of yourself, that you have the space available in your home that can accommodate the amount of children that you're looking to care for. But most agencies will work with you to sort of correct some of those things that might need some changing for you to be able to get there.
Will they talk to friends and relatives of yours as well?
You need to get some referrals, yeah.
Got it.
That they have to write in and give their opinion of you.
Got it.
Most
Got
of
it.
The time it's good.
Yes, don't get people who are going to say nasty things about you.
Right, and sometimes they do.
Right, yeah. Understood. I want to just go back for a second to something it seems really important to me. So you said that there's a stipend.
In foster adoption.
Right. So is that in foster adoption? Is that during the foster period? How long does that last?
In California, which is the only experience I have, there is something during the foster period that they give you. Because remember, some people foster as a business, which is fine. And so there, you know, there is money that they're paid. It's all supposed to go to the child. But so that's what that is to encourage people to be foster parents, to help provide for the necessities.
Sure.
And so you get, you know, a relatively small amount during foster.
Do you mind if I ask, what are we talking about here?
I don't remember exactly.
It kind of varies. I think it depends on the age of the child, depends on whether they have special needs, so they qualify for a different rate. But, you know, for the basic rate, I think in California, or L.A. County at least, it's somewhere between like $700 and $900
a month.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there's also, you get Medi-Cal for each child.
Ah.
So in terms of medical services, you do have the insurance, because you can't put your child into your own insurance.
Because it's not your own. Oh, right.
Correct.
And so now that's during the foster period.
Right.
And then so once the child is legally yours, assuming that you're going mm-hmm. through the entire adoption process, that shuts completely at that moment?
No, there's the post-adoption assistance program where the amount is lowered, maybe by $500, $600 for the basic rate.
Right.
I think it can go all the way up to the age of 20.
Well, so that actually, in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah,
I'm sure it varies all over the place, but that's actually a pretty important consideration for
Absolutely.
A lot of parents.
Yeah. And you get to retain the Medi-Cal as well.
Oh.
You can at that point also put them under your insurance.
Right.
If you have it, correct.
Yeah.
But you have that option as well.
Oh, very interesting.
Okay. Most other states that the amount is much lower. I'm assuming that cost of living has something
correct.
To do with that as
Absolutely.
Well. But the amount's a bit lower, but the same thing happens as far as after adoption, depending on the different needs of the children. There's still a basic rate and all of that stuff that goes on, and it goes till 18, and you can usually increase it if the needs are high enough until 21.
I want to touch one subject before we end, and it's about failed adoption. Nitar, you probably ran into some cases like this in your work. How do you deal with failed adoptions?
There's a lot of different ways that families go about this, you know, if an adoption doesn't work out, if the adoption fails, if the placement doesn't work out for whatever reason on either side. I tell couples to take that break. It is a grieving process. Like we were talking about before with Ethan, like once the baby is placed with you, once the child's placed in your home, there's an instant bond. And regardless of what's going on or who made that decision, you need to take that process to grieve the loss and be able to kind of come out of that. That's why we always encourage finding a support group before you even adopt, so that you're going through it with other people. You can talk to others that have been through it and have that support, but grieving that loss so that you can kind of move on. And then sometimes people decide that they're no longer going to try, that they're done, and some continue on and then adopt later.
Yeah, and sort of tagging on with that, it's not only the grief and loss after there is a reunification or a failed adoption, but pretty much as Ethan was saying, from the very beginning, from the moment they say, oh, the judge changed their mind, we're going to give 6 months of reunification, at that point you already enter that grief mode because you're already having these fantasies that you had when you first started are now starting to be challenged, and your grieving process starts then.
Yeah.
Right. So to be very aware of that, to have a social worker that you feel comfortable with, that you can talk about what those feelings are, to have a partner if it's the case, have a therapist that can talk you through it. But the grieving process doesn't just happen after the child goes back. It happens from the very moment you get that bit of bad news, you know, at some point along the way.
Yeah, and with private adoption, it's frustrating when you don't match and you think you're going to. There was a few where we were down to one of two families, but you've never made a connection with the child. Mm-hmm. With foster adoption, I can't even describe how difficult and how hard the process is and what the lows are like, because it's literally the worst feelings that it's impossible to put into words. And we adopted our child, and yeah. I know how hard it was. I can't comprehend what it would have been like if he were unified. And I think that's the most important thing in terms of the research, because the agency will never tell you that. All that we heard from was people who had succeeded and that it was great. And you should just really know how hard it is and just be in for that, because that will help you. And luckily, this agency had great social workers, and sometimes you just need people to tell you, even if they're not being truthful. I think that's kind of what makes a social worker really great, to say it's going to work out, and somehow they believe it and it helps you. And you need to hear from people that support you. They're realistic, but they support you. And because it is, and I'd be happy to talk to anybody more about it outside of the podcast, it's inconceivable. I mean, you literally, every minute of the day, you see someone else with a child, and in your mind, you're saying you have no idea how good you have it, because right. That's your child.
Yeah.
And my child, maybe, you know, not mine in two more months.
Let me use that to switch to, I don't know if it's our last question. Our last question? Is it our last question? So I believe all of you are adoptive parents,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes.
So I guess the question I have, we're IVF parents. Mm-hmm. This is a world where there are so many kids who, as you mentioned, just in LA County alone, who are waiting for adoption. When you went into the process, let's leave money aside for a minute. When you went into the process, what were your thoughts about the balance of biological kids versus adoption? What made you choose the path that you took? And how do you feel when you look at parents, whether they're, you know, straight parents who just had biological kids or IVF parents like ours? Let's start.
It's a very personal journey for each one. I know in terms of for me and my husband, you know, I have 7 siblings that have given offspring already. And my husband didn't have any need to sort of continue his lineage either. So for us, I worked in child welfare, so I had that personal connection. But it's definitely one of the things that anybody should consider before starting the process, which is go speak to somebody at a surrogacy agency just to see what it's about, even if it's out of your realm, right, of finances. Because it does give you that sense of the research and getting all the information you can. And sometimes, you know, people have opinions about foster care and people who can afford IVF. And so I would say put all that noise aside, really turn in to you and your partner, or if you're single, just to somebody that you trust. And and really ask the question, why do I want to be a parent, right? And of these options that are in front of me, which speak most to my hopes, my dreams, my desires, and what am I capable of doing? And be honest with yourself, and that takes some time to figure out.
Yeah, for us, I mean, in the beginning, finances was important. You know, there's the IVF route is just so much more expensive. And we really did believe in the foster adoption concept and being able to help give a child a life that they otherwise wouldn't be able to have. But I will tell you, in response to your question of how do you look at other parents, I don't remember, literally, mm-hmm. that our kids are adopted. And immediately, there are children, and really, I'd have to remind myself that they're adopted and not biological. And I think everybody should be parents. To me, it's the most amazing thing in the world. And no matter how you have your child, that child may be the one that makes this world a better place. So I don't think it matters how they come to be. And again, we don't think of our kids as adopted. And I've got, unless I literally remind myself, they're no different than anybody else. And I think we're just parents.
And I assessed many families over the years, like over 100 families that I had to study and approve. Oftentimes, the couple wasn't in agreement.
Right.
Whether it was one of them would say, I just don't know that I could love a child that is not biologically mine as much as I could one that is.
Right.
And for some people, that is a reality, and you have to sort of take it at face value, and they have to work through that. But you can't go in looking at foster care and adoption as, well, this is my last option because I can't afford, right? It brings you in with an attitude of almost failure in a way, and it makes you look at yourself as I'm not really getting the opportunity that everybody else is getting. So,
Natara?
Yeah, I think I like all those things you said. I think that a big part of that is being honest, like you said, with yourself or your partner, like making sure that if it's important for one, that you guys talk it out and figure out which, if it's important to have a biological child, I mean, that's something that you look further into, because, you know, as with anything in a relationship, you don't want to start a family and be doing all of that and then come back later and be like, well, I didn't really want to do that. It's not going to work out because there's a child involved. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's important. For us, we had personal connection to foster and adoption, so that's the route that we chose. And I think it's really important to look into all of the different options as well, not just different agencies, but actually going, like, I don't know if Ethan said it or Ufe said it, but it's the going to the you know, the clinics and learning, because there's different, they have different meetings, and you can go and actually listen to a support group or listen, have an appointment at the clinic and get talked to, just to see all of your different options so that you know what's right for you guys. And then also bring your family in. That's something I wanted to bring back from the making sure you're ready and prepared for adoption or being a family in general. Make sure you have a supportive family and a network around you that is kind of on your team. This is a big thing too with single parents that can help, because if the family or, you know, extended family, as so many of our families have, friends that are like family, if those people are on board with you, it's that much better.
Right. Natara, Ofe, and Ethan, thank you guys
thank
so
you
much.
So much.
This is really such a different experience for us, and I really feel like I've not only learned a lot, but gotten kind of emotionally into what you guys have experienced. I will say, not so much that we're about to add another child to our family, because no, but it was wonderful, and thank you guys for
coming.
Thank you guys.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.